this is the magic trick, huh?
Illusion, Michael. Trick is something a whore does for money.
Or cocaine.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul.
And I'm Dennis Freeba.
Dennis is back this weekend. Thanks for coming back, Dennis. We thought we lost you in that blizzard.
Yeah, that awful, awful Florida blizzard that was making us all stay inside and hibernate for a week and a half.
Which ultimately a good thing. This week on the podcast, we have David Kovac, recorded that a couple weeks ago, good man. He has a show in Chicago, a one-man show that he's doing called Fooling Buddha. If you're in Chicago, go check it out. It's very good. I've seen clips of it. I've seen portions of it, I should say, live before, and it's very good. If you like the podcast, please subscribe on iTunes and write us a review, preferably a good one. And if you like us, you can go to our website, twomagiciansonemic.com, and you can give us a little bit of coin, a dollar or two, via PayPal. Our PayPal email is twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. I'm trying not to do sponsors, which I feel like we might end up doing just because it's getting expensive to do this.
yeah, I bet.
Last week I had Justin Willman on, and our downloads just skyrocketed. I don't know if you've looked at the stats, but... thank you, Justin Willman. I appreciate that. But that also means it costs us more money because of the bandwidth and the storage and all that fun stuff. So it's a good problem to have. We've had that problem in the past where downloads just randomly skyrocket. So that was cool. Awesome. How are you doing, Dennis Freebe?
Oh, everything's going great over here. Just working hard, doing some more marketing and just kind of putting myself out there. I've got a lot of different things coming up. The fair that I'm doing out here in Naples is coming up in the end of March. And then I started putting out my video meme series.
Yeah, that's really cool. You posted that up on the Two Magicians page, right?
Yeah. So I'm putting out one every Friday for the month. I've got four that I'm putting out. And they're just like these just ideas and things that that are personal to me, that I make part of my life, like individuality and freedom and things like that. So it's just basically going through all this footage that I have and have collected for many different reasons, and then just kind of putting it out there and putting a nice video together that kind of just explains a little bit more of who I am rather than just being a talking head, because it's kind of boring when you're just a talking head.
Sure. Is the idea behind that to kind of invoke your character and kind of give your own perspective on performance and magic?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's just more of, you know, not focusing so much on the trick itself, where in the first one, you didn't really see much of a trick, individuality. But in the last one I just put out, Freedom, it was, you got to see me actually performing a couple magic tricks here and there at a, for one of my major clients, the West Chase Foundation.
That's
they
cool.
put on, they put on something every year called Tampa Bay Woman of the Year. And I perform at their events whenever I'm available.
For a brief second, I thought you were going to say you got nominated. And I was going to say, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
I'm like, they.
We all have our secrets.
Like, I feel like there's some more successful women in Tampa than. But, hey, but whatever, equality, it's great.
Right.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I'm doing some marketing stuff myself. Just redid my website for the kajillionth time, and I've kind of given up on making it SEO friendly because it's just a never ending process. But now it's a lot faster and it's a lot just to the point and. Because I'm looking, you can kind of look at the stats of how long somebody checks out your website, and it's literally like 30 seconds, you know? They'll watch a video or two, if that, and then they'll move on, or they'll send you an inquiry. So
I
think you got to be just to the point with these things.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There's you can only go, you know, with the SEO stuff so far, And the thing is it's constantly changing. You know, Google is constantly changing the way that.
That's the exhausting part. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's always different. It's like, wait, like this is not relevant anymore. Why? Mm-hmm.
You can be like number one for a week or two or a month. And then all of a sudden you're just not popping up anymore. And it's just because either you're not blogging enough or your site is suddenly not, you know, hitting the search marks that Google's looking for. And
right.
I heard it said well, like I was listening to an SEO guy and he's like, you know, Google's job is to help its user. They don't really care about you.
Right.
They want to make sure the user is getting exactly what they're looking for. So if they search something and you don't fit that criteria, you're not going to show up, obviously, because you're not helping the user out.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And another thing that they do is it's also very, it's regional, like it's per area, per city. Like when you make the search, like if you just type in plumber, like it will start bringing up plumbers in your area. It's not just going to like bring up plumbers all over the US because that doesn't do the user any good if they're searching for a plumber.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like all those little details and specifications of things I pretend to understand, but have no clue. It's just very confusing. And I'm very close to hiring somebody to do SEO. I'm just like fine shelling out a couple grand and say like, okay, you do it. Even though I really don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I was going to talk about this week. I had the pleasure of performing at the Comedy and Magic Club, and that was pretty cool. I never performed there before, and was quite intimidated. And, like, you walk in there, and it's just a wall of pictures of famous comedians. You know, like, literally the picture you walk past right as you're walking on stage is Robin Williams, and it's a signature. And it's, like, you know, a pretty recent photo of him performing there, you know.
Right.
The past couple of years, so you know those type of guys, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go up and do my shtick, and luckily it went over really well, and it was a good space, good crowd, but it's just I've never been so intimidated in a while. You know, you get used to your routine, but man, it was it was a journey.
Yeah, it was a great set, and I liked it.
Oh, thank you. It's up on the Facebook page if anyone wants to watch it. But I'll be back there at the end of March. They gave me a week, so that'd be cool. But nice. It just kind of made me think about overcoming challenges and just kind of sticking to your guns. Because there's a lot that can get inside your head.
Oh, yeah.
Anything else happening over there before we throw it to the interview? Because you were talking about marketing, any specific marketing tips or things you've discovered that work out?
I'm just really trying to connect with the client more on a personal level. You know, everything is so like SEO and email marketing and this kind of stuff. And I'm trying to take a more personal approach. And I've had a lot of success with, you know, mailing out postcards and then making a direct connection with somebody that has an interest in me. So it's kind of like you know, you send out like thousands of postcards and then you get like one response. And then that's the person that, you know, is the person, or that's the company, or that's the agent or whatever that you build a relationship with, because there was something there that they really liked about you. And, you know, then you have phone conversations with them and either it leads somewhere eventually or immediately or something like that. But just trying to build more personal and meaningful relationships with individuals and with my clients. So, you know, like for instance, the West Chase Foundation, I've been working with you guys for years, you know, and anytime something comes up, it's like, and one of their main board members, like he invites me over to his house and things like that. So that's like, that's an important thing. It's not just a business thing anymore. Now it's like a friendship and a relationship that, you know, that means something. You know, people don't just invite you to their house for, you know, for whatever, but so that's more of the things that I'm really trying to look at, is making things much more personal. You know, you can send somebody an email or a Facebook message or like their page or whatever, but, you know, what does that really mean? But when you're having a face-to-face conversation with them and shaking their hand at a trade show, that's much more meaningful, and they get to see you, and they get to feel you, and they get to feel your energy, and they get to feel what you're all about, you know, so...
Yeah, I'm learning that here big time. You know, you can email all you want and it's fine, but you know, I haven't started to book anything until you get to know these people on a one-on-one basis, and it has to be organic, and it can't be forced, and it can't feel like networking. It has to just, you know, you just have to, like you said, build a relationship with these people. And that's, I'm finding the only, in this world that we're in now of so many options and just Google searching for entertainment, that people are more likely to book the people that they can, you know, have a solid foundation with and, you know, see as a real person and not just a picture.
Yeah. I went to a networking event and somebody invited me and I was like, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Let me go to a networking event, you know, and it's like at this restaurant, it's real nice and it's good. And, you know, everybody's having a good time. And everybody that I run into, they just want to tell me what they do and what they're about. But they have no interest in me at all.
Sure.
I didn't really tell anybody that I'm a magician. I hardly handed out my card because I'm not there like necessarily to like push myself onto them. I don't like that. You know, I don't like to, like you said, it has to feel organic. People don't want to be sold to, but they do want to buy. And so everybody's just like, oh, this is me and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, okay. And they had no interest in me. They didn't even ask me, oh, so what do you do? What mm-hmm. are you doing here? You know, and it's like, it was very kind of like turned me off and I didn't go again. I'm like,
yeah, they, I got requests. There's a lot of those in Orlando. I imagine there's a lot in LA too, but I got requests for those all the time from people. Like sometimes you have to buy into them and sometimes.
Yeah. Pay $20 to get in. It's not a big deal. You get a couple drink tickets and mm-hmm. whatever, and there's food and blah, blah, blah. But it was like, ugh.
Yeah. But if, yeah, it's like you said, if everybody's trying to sell to you, it just kind of becomes bogged down. And I know it works for certain guys, and I guess it just probably depends on the type of event. But
I know the other part of it also is that you have to keep going. You know, again, it's that some people constantly see you and then you're always around and now you're like, so like, what do you really do? And blah, 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 and this and that, you know, so.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was just not in that particular crowd. It just wasn't for me. I was like, yeah. I'd rather take my time going to trade shows, have a booth, and, you know, people that are actually physically interested in buying, they're going to come up and be like, oh, what is this all about? What kind of magician are you? What kind of magic do you do? What are your shows like? You know, and then you give them the full on or the booth experience.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, for sure. For sure. That makes sense. Oh, anything else you want to throw in here before we go to the interview?
Freedom. Check it out.
Freedom. There you go. Are you working for Donald Trump? What's going on here?
No way.
You're going to make America great again. All right. Yeah, definitely check it out. It's up on the Two Magicians page. And yeah, I think that's about it for today. Good chatting with you, Dennis.
Yeah, man.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Well, we're just jumping in right here. We are speaking with the lovely David Kovac. How are you, David?
I'm great. I'm great. Good to see you, Nick.
And a lovely house that you're renting here in this classic Studio City. What is it? What type of house is this? What would you describe
it
as?
I don't know. I guess I would call it an old sort of – it has an English cottage mm-hmm. kind of quality to it. And so here we are. And yeah, and then we'll be heading back to – we've been here just over a year. And then we have been in Chicago, Lisandra, Tena, and I. Mm-hmm. And so we've been in Chicago. Now we're going to be heading back because I'm going to be doing a play with First Folio Theater mm-hmm. That I wrote called Fooling Buddha. But in any event, it's good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. And we go back – you know, I've known you since like 2008. We used to perform at Navy Pier together, and that's how – I always had a pleasure. It was always fun when we got to piggyback and go back because – you know, your style is so different from my style. So even though we were both doing magic, I always felt like it was such a good, fun show for the audience because they were getting to see two different styles of magic.
Well, that's right. It was a lot of fun at Navy Pier, too, for us and people, you know, who – and it wasn't just magicians, of course. I mean,
sure.
There were people who did improv, or there were – troops that were singers, this kind of a thing, or maybe a puppeteer, different sort of variety artists, mm-hmm. you know, performing there on the various stages. And at one point, there were quite a lot of stages. I don't know if they had something going on the, like the Family Follies on the Skyline stage when you were there. But at one point, there was the Family Pavilion stage, and then this is at Navy Pier in Chicago, right along the lake. There was the Dock Street stage. There was one stage, I think they called like the Yellow Stage or the Flag Stage or something, like way, way east, mm-hmm. like almost practically in the water. and then there were roving troops. There was also what they called Piermosphere, where people would just rove around the pier and juggle or do whatever they were doing. So at one point... there were really quite a lot of performers working at Navy Pier, and it was a good gig.
And now it's like nothing. They cut everything.
I don't know what's happening. They're quote-unquote reimagining the pier. Man, I wish they'd reimagine it more rapidly because every time you go there, you think, okay, so I'm paying all this money to park, and there's really nothing happening.
Exactly.
There's Shakespeare Theater there where there was a wonderful play recently co-directed, or at least directed in part, by Teller, The Tempest.
Yeah.
And that had a lot of magic in it with
my friend Barbara Yanda. Robertson was in that.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
And it got... you know, amazing reviews. I wish I could have saw it.
Yeah,
seen it.
Yeah. I know. Me too. And I tried with a friend of mine, but it was sold out, oversold. So, you know, you can't see everything. But with a production like that, I have a feeling that we'll have another chance.
Yeah. It's very. I would be very surprised. But getting back to you, so we're going to talk about your show that you'll be doing in Chicago. That's going to have quite an extensive run called Fooling Buddha, which I've seen portions of. Wonderful show, and. I think even if you're not a magician, you will greatly be inspired by it, especially from a theatrical perspective. But if you could give us like a brief bio about where you come from, like 2 minutes,
sure.
Your style.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about before we actually flipped on the mics, we different people come to magic from different areas. You know, some people come to performance through magic, and other people come to magic and magical entertainment through other areas of performance, whether they're actors or stand-ups, uh-huh. Improv people. So me, I had been an actor since I was a kid, and then I was fortunate enough to study with a local theater group. I grew up in Milwaukee, like a theater school for young people. In fact, it was called the theater school. And then I went to an arts high school. So by the time I went to the theater school at DePaul, which was known at one time as the Goodman School of Drama, I'd already had quite a lot of theater training, but no magic, really. I was a juggler. I really enjoyed juggling. And then when I graduated from, you know, I got a BFA, so it was a conservatory program there at the theater school at DePaul. And that was a very, very strong program, very intense training, you know. So you're going to learn how to act. If you go there, you're not going to get out of the theater school and not know how to beat a scene into shape, you know. With beats and intentions and all this kind of stuff, and have a good physicality and some sense of vocal. You'll be probably fairly nimble vocally because you're studying all those things in a very intense way, just like studying music or anything else. So I got out of school and I did many, many plays, and then I thought, well, why be an actor if you have an act? So I'm going to get back to the juggling. I'm going to be a juggler. That's what I'm going to do, like a comedy juggler. And I really loved, you know. Some of the acts that you would still see on Johnny Carson, you know, whether it was Michael Davis or George Carl or people who... I really enjoyed the comedy and juggling and all that stuff and the sort of vaudevillian kind of scene. So I got into that, but then... and then I had a show called Catching Fire because I juggled fire in the show. And I had comedy and jazz music and all these fun things. But then, unfortunately, I had some repetitive stress injuries because of juggling, mm-hmm. Which not a lot of people talk about. But in both juggling and in magic, it is easy to get, you know, to develop repetitive stress injuries if you're practicing hours a day. So then I had to change that up because I was on television shows, but not doing my act. I was on television shows like Art Beat with Dr. Branfenbrenner, who founded the Performing Artists Clinic. And these shows were about performers who had these horrible injuries, you know? So I was thinking, wait a minute, this wasn't the idea because I could barely use my left arm for a while. I mean, it was really getting bad.
Yeah.
Nerve problems are very serious too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows no pain, no gain. But if in your practice, whatever it is, you start to realize that, you know, I mean, there's tingling and your arm is numb and you're losing strength, or there anything that might indicate that there's a serious problem more than just a little soreness, you got to listen to your body. You got to pay attention to that stuff. So anyway, so there'd be like violinists and ballet dancers with a bad knee. And then there was me. And then they'd be like, but David Kovac, he's a juggler. This is interesting. So how'd you get injured? Was it a chainsaw? No chainsaw. Well, were you juggling machetes and then like something landed? No, that wasn't it. I just over-juggled. I literally almost juggled my arm off.
Weird.
Because, you know, like our friend Terrence, you know Terrence Francisco, very skillful sleight of hand guy back in Chicago. And he used to say, I don't believe in talent. I only believe in obsessive compulsive sort of behavior.
Yeah.
You know, until you just get really, really good. There's no such thing as talent. There's just obsession. Well, so I, you know... So that's, I got an injury, and it really was a drag. But then I started learning more magic, and I was doing a gig in Atlanta, and I met Danny Orleans on a trade show floor, and he was doing his corporate magic, and he's very good at that. And he said, you know, you should really learn more magic and put that in your act instead, because you know you've got a good personality for it, and you could learn some stuff. And then I started hiring him to teach me some basic magic. Mm-hmm. That's how I got into it.
Yeah. Where does your vaudevillian character come from? Is that something that interests you outside of magic, or is that something that you created, that character you created for the stage?
I always liked it. You know, when I was a kid, I really liked, you know, vaudevillian stuff. Even today, you can say to kids, like, shaving a haircut, and they'll all say two bits, and they kind of know where that stuff comes from, whether it's Looney Tunes or Marx Brothers films, or whether it's watching old episodes of The Muppet Show. Who knows? But they're somewhat familiar with that kind of vaudevillian thing. Like, there's supposed to be a red velvet curtain, and then there's supposed to be, like, some guy doing, like, a tap dance. Sure. And then, oh, yeah, and now they have, like, a singing act. And, oh, and here's a magician. You know, we just, that archetypal image is still... It's still there. It's still present. It's people recognize it. Even young people who are too young to remember vaudeville or anything like vaudeville, whether it's burlesque or maybe they're not even old enough to remember stand-up comedy, but yeah. They sort of recognize when they see, like, whether it's Matt King or the juggler Dieter Tasso. I remember always enjoying him. He would catch cups and saucers, you know, teacups and saucers in a stack on his head by kicking them up from his feet, and he would just catch them on his head. So I was always... I think, too, Nick, a lot of it probably comes from the fact that having been an actor since I'd been a kid, I wasn't always sure what made somebody a good actor, or I especially wasn't sure what made somebody a great actor. It was difficult to tell. It's also subjective. But when you're doing a skill-based act, then people – it's very easy to identify, oh, okay, so this person belongs on stage. Because yeah. They're actually doing something. They're doing something that I can't do, or that normal people can't do, or that we don't often see.
Yeah.
Whether that's being really, really good at telling jokes and being silly, like Donald O'Connor in that wonderful sort of make them laugh and Singing in the Rain, or whether it's somebody who's actually tap dancing, doing something involving a skill, or juggling or magic. I just always enjoyed that sort of, like I said, that archetype, that sort of paradigm of here's going to somebody, because the audience is going to be always asking three questions as soon as the curtain parts or you turn on the television or a new character enters the scene in a movie or a television show. Who are you? What are you doing? And why is this special?
Yeah.
So I always thought an act is, you know, to have some sort of skill-based act is fun. Even if it's not mad skills, like you don't have to be doing a manipulation act. Mm-hmm. It's fine just, you know, if some sort of animal finally jumps through your little... circle, and then that's the end.
I think that's what I enjoy most about your show is that I've never seen you perform with any huge, big apparatuses. Everything is very well contained, and your character drives everything that you're doing. Is that intentional?
Yeah, because, you know, if you come to magic late in life, like I did, relatively late in life, then you want to have magic that is strong and direct and powerful and all those things right away or as soon as possible. And it takes years to learn to play a musical instrument well. Mm-hmm. And it takes years to really develop a serious book as a singer, you know, Great American Songbook, or maybe you're doing musicals, or maybe you're doing classical music, whatever it is. That takes a long, long time, I think. So, you know, I never really wanted to do a manipulation act or get myself into something that I couldn't really perform well consistently. And by the same token, there's a lot of room for creativity and comedy and magic. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. You can do something that is unique. People will remember mm-hmm. you for that.
Would you touch on the show that you're doing in Chicago called Fooling Buddha? You've done it before.
Right. I've done it a couple of times. And that show, I was raised in a Buddhist family, so there's a lot of philosophical humor in the show. You know, like I believe in reincarnation. That's why in my will I'm leaving everything to myself. You know, jokes like that. But it takes a more serious turn, too. It's all about that fundamental battle that we all have, really, with ourselves, the battle between the bully and the Buddha. You know, the Buddha being, you know, the more enlightened, creative, and expansive, compassionate, wise sort of tendency that we have, and then there's the bully, you know, that sort of negativity that we all struggle with, mm-hmm. and that fundamental self-doubt, whether you're in show business or not. And the question in Buddhism is really not unlike the question in show business, you know, can you become stronger than your own negativity? Because if you can, then, you know, you could maybe do great things, or be happy or create value in this world or in whatever you're doing. But to become stronger than your own negativity is a difficult thing. And anyhow, so the show does take not a dark turn of the heart necessarily, but I mean, but there's some more serious subject matter in the play. It's a solo piece. But there's wonderful, there's fun stuff in it, wonderfully funny stuff. I mean, I wrote it, and it's being developed and directed by Patrick New, so I hope that the audience will enjoy it. But there's also very fun magic in it. Yeah. You know, it's sort of like you learn to battle the bully through magic and misdirection when you're the only Buddhist kid growing up in Milwaukee, and it's 1979, and you have to do a show, you know, at the Samuel Morris Middle School Auditorium. You know, it's so there's some really fun stuff in there. And I hope people will... We'll enjoy this.
Where's it playing at, and what are the dates?
It's at First Folio Theater in Oak Brook. So it's not really in Chicago. It's just outside of Chicago, but not by much. And it will open on the 23rd of March, I believe, and then close on the 24th of April. It could possibly be extended, but right now that's the plan.
Okay.
So, but yeah, there will definitely be some magic in that show. And it's a funny thing about selecting magic, whether it's a play or for just selecting a foreign act. It really is. You have to have good taste, don't you, in magic?
Yeah. That touches on my next question. What are your influences outside of magic in terms of acting, music, dance?
Boy, it's a good question. Well, I mentioned earlier Michael Davis, and that's really interesting because he never really did that much technical stuff at all. I don't think he really did any technical stuff. And there were magicians that did that too, the great Ballantine, and you know, the magicians who did very little magic. But their sense of character was so strong. I just saw an interesting performer at the Magic Castle. Like I said, I was performing there this last weekend for the Palace Brunch shows, and it was kind of nice to not be completely exhausted at the castle, like having been doing shows there all week, every night, and then you go in for the Palace Brunch shows. Yeah. It's kind of fun to go in, and I met that interesting character named Master Payne.
Okay.
And so Master Payne has the type of character where he does one trick like in his whole act at the very end.
Really?
He's a coin in the bottle. Yeah, it's only one trick in the whole act. I've never seen an act like that at the castle.
How long does he do?
He does like a full, he did a full set. I mean, I don't know if it was quite a half hour, but I mean, he did a full show. Yeah, this is quite bizarre.
Huh.
Only one trick. But I mean, hey, and for some people are going to leave and say, well, now wait a minute, there should have been more magic. But other people leave and say, I thought that was just delightful. And he, you know, his writing is very good. He's very funny. He's very thoughtful. It's very clever. It's just a different emphasis.
Yeah.
It's really a different emphasis. I mean, I think for certain musicians, you know, they would probably say, this is not real jazz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It just kind of depends where you're coming from it. And, you know,
I think so too. You know, but I think my influences were definitely the more theatrical performers.
Sure.
For sure. And that would include, you know, everybody that we knew from the old films. You know, W.C. Fields was a great juggler. W.C. Fields was a wonderful character, too, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my character's not quite that cynical. He was a pretty caustic and abrasive and, you know, sort of foreboding character in a lot of ways. But, I mean... but it was that whole scene, that whole style, everything Chaplin did. You know, even Cary Grant, people forget that these were vaudevillians too.
Yeah.
They all came from different areas of...
That's why they were, I think they translated so well into making so many films, you know, constantly that everybody would see. It was kind of the same thing they were doing in vaudeville.
Well, yeah, and in those days, like I said, somewhere along the line, we all got separated, and I don't know how that happened. But it used to be, I mean, vaudeville was the first mass-produced entertainment product in America, but it was also the first meritocracy. It was the first integrated workplace. It was the first place where, well, obviously men and women, too, were working together.
Sure.
I mean, if you had talent and you could, there was small time, medium time, and big time, but if you had talent and you were serious about it, you could, and you were willing to sort of run away from home, you really could be in show business and you might make it, or you would make it. I mean, it might not be big time, but you could do it. And a lot of these acts, you know, vaudeville probably died because a lot of the acts really weren't that great when it comes down to it. But we know that some of them were just fantastic and really quite inspired. So somewhere along the line, we all got separated performers, but it didn't used to be that way. They were all together under one leaky roof, you know,
or
sharing a train car or something along those lines, or hotels. There used to be signs in hotels that said no actors allowed because they would notoriously not pay their bills or break things or cause trouble or mm-hmm. turn the place upside down and you know, or be getting drunk or, you know, who knows.
Not too far off from what happens
today. Yeah, perhaps not. But there were, you know, there would always be somebody around with a deck of cards, or there would always be somebody around to teach you some sort of new lick on your guitar, or there would always be somebody around to show you a new dance step, or mm-hmm. you'd see somebody flipping around on a, you know, a, something, gymnasts or people who do all, you know, contortionists, or there'd be somebody doing something. So that's how they all kind of learned hat tricks. That's why Cary Grant could do hat tricks and stuff, because he came from that world.
Sure, sure.
You know? Interesting stuff.
I remember talking to you back in Chicago about this. Do you feel like a part of you should have been born during that vaudeville era?
I used to think that maybe I was born too late, but if anything, I feel like I might have been born a bit too early, because I don't really know that I would have truly wanted to live back then. It was a tough time to be around. There's a fascinating book called No Applause, Just Throw Money, the book that made vaudeville famous, and I don't know if you've ever seen that book or thumbed through it. It's probably here on my shelf somewhere, but that, you know, you do get the sense that it was the best of times and so forth, but it was also pretty rough.
Yeah.
You know, in that book, for example, you read about a fellow by the name of Frank Fay, who was the first modern, you know, vaudevillian. In other words, he was an MC and a host of shows, and would come out on stage and would just tell jokes and wear like a regular business suit, you know, and probably a nice hat, like a fedora. But he wasn't wearing a polka dot vest or you know, baggy pants or with a cane and, you know, some sort of goofy hat, going, you know, yucka yucka yucka. He wasn't doing that kind of goofy stuff. He was making smart jokes and doing actual improv. And if I'm not mistaken, he would have audience shills or plants or Confederates or whatever you want to call them in the audience, and he would banter back and forth with them. And maybe some of that stuff happened spontaneously with actual hecklers. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But he was very smart, very stand-up comedian, very very quick-witted, and the precursor to, or the sort of prototype for all of the late-night television talk show hosts that you see today. They all owe that sort of archetype and that idea to this fellow by the name of Frank Fay. Someone told me one time that Max Maven was so fascinated by Frank Fay that he was going to write was considering writing a book about him. I don't know if that's true or not, but he'd be an interesting subject for people to learn about. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he wasn't the nicest guy. I guess he was a raging alcoholic. He ended up marrying Barbara Stanwyck, and then they moved to Hollywood, and she became a huge star, and he became kind of a forgotten, lonely, angry drunk.
Interesting.
You know, I don't know that that's, again, I can't corroborate all this. I haven't written the books. I've just read some of them, you know. But it's a very interesting thing, you know, that you think, oh, so everybody from, like, whether it's Penn and Teller or people like, I don't know, contemporary hosts like Jimmy Fallon or all from Carson, like all the way down. Oh, so like everybody owes something to this guy that nobody ever talks about, Frank Fay. The first guy to walk out on stage as a normal person and start doing like stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all late night television and SNL and sketch. I mean, it all seems to stem from some form of vaudeville.
I know, it really does. And by the way, he might not really have been the first, or there may have been several people doing it at the same time, like a George Burns, and then there was a Jack Benny. But it seemed like, if you really read this stuff, the guys who really do their research say that Frank Fay was actually the one who really had an impact doing that. Probably at the Palace, probably in New York City, you know, where there was always, you know, shows going on, and that was really making it big. That he was really the one who should be credited for coming up on stage and being spontaneous in front of a crowd.
Sure. Getting back to the questions here, what do you like and what do you dislike about the current state of magic and where it's going or headed or?
Well,
coming from,
there's, you know, being so close, I mean, having been in the Los Angeles area for the last year and being so close to the Magic Castle has really been a boon, you know, because you can just go there all the time and see really wonderful people. I mean, the best in the world. And I've had the great fortune to perform with people there from all over the place. You know, that just doesn't happen back home in Chicago. There's not a lot of venues remaining. I've performed with Jorge Blas from Spain and from... There was a fellow I haven't seen recently named Darcy Oak from Canada, a dove magician. He was obviously coming from Canada. People from England. There's, you know, I mean, there's just people. Oh, and Japan. You know, people come from Japan, Korea. One time I performed with a Korean manipulator who was quite talented. And Jung Pyo Hung, I believe is his name. I may be mispronouncing his name, so I apologize. But it's been a while. It's been years since I've seen him. Anyway, the vaudevillian, the true vaudevillian, not a modern day vaudevillian, David Kaplan. I mean, David Kaplan is wonderful. So being at the castle, you know, you see so many performers and everyone has a different style. I mean, there may be five people doing the gypsy thread that you may see, but they're going to be doing it very, very differently. Rob Zabrecki has a completely different presentation than, you know, Eugene Berger, who I'm sure did it very differently than Billy McComb, you know, like we were talking about before. So you see different people's takes on this stuff, and it's important. But I was having a conversation with Lisa, who the librarian at the castle, who's very supportive of all the magicians there, but she has said that some people really do make an attempt to connect emotionally with their audiences in a much stronger way than other magicians. And that's something that we would all like to see more of. Mm-hmm. You know, who are the performers that can really make a serious connection, an emotional connection with their audience through their magic? And when I think of that, that's something I would like to see more of.
Yeah.
Suzanne, the magician from the Minneapolis area, she does a wonderful job of that, talking about, you know, the real magic that exists if you're a mom, you know, if you're a mommy, and mommies have this tremendous love, and that, you know, through that and with that and because of that, anything is possible. And this is the kind of magic that moms can do. It's very special. So it's powerful stuff. And Eugene Berger has, you know, talked a lot over the years about presentation and how to make your magic meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some people who get that, but it's a hard thing to do, to really connect in a deeper way with your audience through your magic.
Especially there sometimes too, because it can be such a drunken fiasco after 10 o'clock. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah, it has. And of course, you know, it's a drinking establishment. There's what, five bars in the castle, maybe more, you know, it does walk that line, but it's the audiences there are the best audiences for magic and the variety arts, I think, in general in the world. Without exception, because they come there to see variety entertainers and magicians specifically. They get dressed up. There's no distractions. There's no cell phones. They're not taking pictures. There's no children allowed. I mean, everybody's there and sort of putting their best face forward to come and really celebrate and see intimate shows. Because even the Palace is not a huge venue.
Yeah.
The Palace at the Palace of Mystery at the Magic Castle is not a huge venue.
It's like, what, 200 maybe?
I don't know the exact number, but I would say it's less.
It doesn't feel like that.
200. Yeah. Yes, it's not.
It's like 150 max.
It's not a huge space. And that, so it, because all those spaces are intimate, some of the rooms are, you know, you do have amplified sound, but still the feeling is very intimate, whether you're in the parlor or certainly the close-up gallery, the Peller Theater. And there's other theaters there, or there's other spaces there too. I've seen intimate performances in the inner circle, you know, just down there by the W.C. Fields bar, where there's no actual theater, but people just sort of gather around and do things even outside the bar area. So, you know, there's many opportunities there to create very strong, very powerful theater. It's just the theater is very cozy. It's very small.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I would like to see is people taking their magic a bit more seriously because it's just such hard work. You know, to really get good at this stuff takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so people should respect it, but on both sides.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You know,
we ask everybody this, what you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but I'm always curious as to hear about people's best gig stories and worst gig stories. Rob Zabrecki gave a great one when I talked to him a couple days ago, and it was, I would have been terrified if I was there, but has anything come to mind for you in terms of like, greatest opportunity that's come your way or most exciting thing you've done versus most negative thing you've done?
Well, it's funny because, you know, we were just talking about Navy Pier in Chicago, which I would describe, you know, conversely, right? It's not the Magic Castle, but it is, on the other hand, it is the most public of public venues. You know, it's what I call oftentimes, especially in the summer, the sticky fingers crowd. You know, if you have someone select a playing card, I mean, it's just hell's guess what could be on their hands.
Oh,
cotton candy, peanuts, it could be halfway through a burger. There's generally salt involved and, you know, all kinds. And it's the summer and people are anything but, you know, sort of formal in the way that they're dealing with you. And one time I was performing on the Dock Street stage at Navy Pier. I did over 1,000 shows there for a period of about 15 years. You know, like I was never there every day, but I was there, you know, several times, maybe in a month or something like that. And one time during a show on the Dock Street stage, there were all these people gathered around and it was, you know, I had a good sized crowd and a bride and groom in full bride and groom sort of ensemble, whatever you would call it, dressed as a bride and groom, came down the pier, and they came and walked on stage in the middle of my set. So
this is a stage to paint a picture, has giant speakers, lights. Clearly a show is happening.
Oh, clearly a show is happening.
It's not just a street show.
Yeah, and Nick alluded to the fact earlier that I don't really have a lot of props. I mean, I'm not doing illusions and so forth. I have props, but they're just, it's a suitcase act, you know, mm-hmm. like you might, I mean, if you're familiar with it, a suitcase act. Anyhow, I mean, but clearly the suitcase was there on a stool on the stage, and there's lights and there's sound and there's people. There's union sound guys on the side of the stage, and then there's a huge crowd of people in front of you watching the show on a stage. And it's the summer; it's like 4th of July weekend or whatever. So the bride and groom just walks on stage, and then their photographer, because of course they had a whole entourage, stands in front of the stage and starts taking photos. Now remember, I'm a talking act, so I mean, I've got a micro. I'm in the middle of, you know, I'm saying something like, "Yes, you know, four cards and four cards only, and you know, he who has choice has torment. So follow the ace; that's the lucky card. And in the language of the cards, the ace. The ace always represents ambition. But beware. Congratulations on your wedding. Anyhow, so the ace, which is currently in the band of my hat, always represents ambition. Now, be wary of ambition, especially when it's your own. Hi, can I help you? I see that you're here on my stage, and it's my show. And they're from some Eastern European country, like they're not speaking English. And the photographer's taking pictures, and there's all these people wondering, what exactly is going on? Like, mm-hmm. do they pick a card now, or like, what happens? So I did a card trick with them. I just turned around and said, okay, well, you're in the act now. And then they smiled and kind of took a bow and left.
Weird.
So when people say Chicago's known for improv, I mean, I guess.
Well, it's that situation. It's like you can get mad at that. That kind of stuff would happen to me at Disney all the time. And it's like,
at Disney, yeah, sure.
There would be times where you're just like, you want to be done. It's your last show. You want to go home. And then something absurd will happen, like a drunk person. And it's like, okay, do you make the best of this? Do you make a joke out of it? Or do you get really angry at this person and maybe end up losing your job? Always better to, in my opinion, laugh at it and then get angry after the show's done. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like, that's a kinder, gentler example of goofy stuff that's happened. Although, you know, an honest answer to that question is, when I was still at the theater school and I was just about to graduate, there was a cabaret in Chicago that for a while they were calling New Variety Cabaret, and then I think they changed the name to New Variety Theater. And I started doing that my last year at the theater school. Well, they didn't want performers performing professionally, and I wasn't doing magic at that time, but I was a juggler. And so I would paint my face as a mime and go to this cabaret like really, really late at night. It was above this restaurant called the Bellagio. Anyway, apparently this building was an old haunted bordello, and that's the truth, like from, you know, Chicago in the sort of gangster days in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this producer had this idea to make this cabaret, and there were people, you know, playing the saxophone, and then there would be someone doing, I don't know, perhaps some kind of torch song, and then I would come out and I would sing I Left My Heart in San Francisco with my face painted as a mime, and then I would juggle, fire and a knife and all, and eat the apple, that whole thing. And one night I decided it would be a really good idea, and I was probably about 19 years old at the time, I decided it would be a really good idea to drink a lot of whiskey before the show. So I'm here to tell you that drinking and juggling, especially dangerous objects, really don't mix. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really, really hard lesson. I had a bad show, and I just kept chasing it and chasing it and chasing it. I kept dropping everything again and again and again. And the producer was actually there, and I think I had friends in the audience, and they were kind of sitting all along the back wall. It was pretty crowded, you know, downtown Chicago. I was, as I say, probably about 19, and I think I probably had like 10 drops. I mean, I just kept on dropping everything, and then finally just finished, you know, to the best that I could, and kind of literally stumbled off stage drunk, and I got fired. And then, wow. Yeah, I was invited to come like the next day and come and clean out my dressing room, and that's when I realized, oh man, they're probably going to hire Andy Head, which they should have done to begin with. but I really, you know, I kind of learned a lesson there about, you know, just because the establishment may offer you free drinks, doesn't mean it's the best idea. So I think, you know, nobody got hurt, but you know, we learned some hard lessons with this stuff. It's stressful. Mm-hmm. You know,
I don't know how magicians and guys, I mean, I love a beer and, you know, scotch as much as the next guy, but I think I've maybe done a couple corporate shows where they're like, can I get you anything to drink, and I had maybe a couple sips of beer, and then I'll do my show and I'll finish it. But I don't know, for me, it's very challenging to lose any type of control in a one-man show.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with friends of mine back in Chicago who are also magicians, or some of my friends who do Magic Chicago, or like I mentioned earlier, Danny Orleans and his wife Jan Rose, and they do this mind reading act. We talk about that. You know, you can never be smarter than your audience, but you can always be more prepared.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that you know are prepared is to be sort of mentally prepared too. You know, so that when everybody else is drinking, especially at a place like the Magic Castle, you're not. And so you already have an incredible advantage.
Yeah.
You know, because you're just so you're so deft. You're so acutely aware of what's going on.
And I've seen guys get away with stuff just that they shouldn't be getting away with at the castle because the audience is so hammered.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's certainly true.
And so I've called out friends on that. I'm like,
oh, really?
You can't do this anywhere else unless it's post 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. But
you're
getting away with it.
Right.
Good for you.
Right, like trying to palm, you know, like an entire basket of fruit. Mm-hmm. Well, they'll never see. Am I flashing? What do you mean flashing? They can't see this.
They can't see the banana.
They're scullied.
Yeah.
No, so that was, I mean, you do, I think, want to make some effort to comport yourself in the manner of a classy person, and certainly a gentleman. You know, you never want to flirt too hard with other people's dates and do, you know, that goofy stuff that, you know, the old timers seem to used to be able to get away with. I don't know how they did.
But I don't know.
Like that magic lounge kind of stuff, like Heba Heba Aller. You know, you hear these stories of these old men that would treat women with such, I mean, they would take such liberties with touching women and doing tricks with their brassieres.
Yeah.
I don't think you can really do that as much today.
You see, I mean, it's certainly not that by any means, but I've seen a couple older magicians performing there, and maybe a couple lines that they'll kind of spit out shouldn't be being said anymore. It just doesn't work. And I'm not coming up with any specific examples, but it does come down to, you know, people treating women or whoever differently, you know, 50 years ago, and then trying to get away with those lines today. It's like, I think the culture's changed quite a bit, so you can't do it.
Yeah, the culture's changed. And, you know, I think you and I have talked about Steve Martin's interesting book called Born Standing Up.
Yeah, that's my Bible.
That's a great book, right? Mm-hmm. And in that book, he talks about, you know, at one point, he decided he didn't want anything in his act that didn't come from him.
Sure.
So he didn't want to be doing these classic lines, and no matter And not just the goofy ones, like, hold out your hand, no, the clean one, or, you know, what's your name? Doris. That's correct. You know, I mean, it's not just those goofy old lines that everybody uses, but he really didn't want anything in his show that wasn't representative of his unique comic perspective, whatever that might be, in his character and so forth. Again, who are you? What are you doing? And why should I care? The audience needs to know that.
Yeah, and he failed for 7 years because of that. You know, it took him like 7 to 10 years to figure out his character. And he could have easily kept on going, doing stuff that he knew worked, but he didn't want to be known as somebody doing somebody else's material. And I think a lot of people need to, I mean, that was a wake-up call for me the first time I read that part in the book. And I think, you know, a lot of people need to take a look at that and examine that in their own act.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, and it's funny because we've sort of come full circle. If there's going to be, because we were talking earlier about duplication of material, like when you play the Magic Castle, or there's repetition of effects or even themes, if you're doing all original work, you don't ever have to worry about other magicians doing your stuff, unless, of course, they steal it from you, which does happen. I know, for example, I've spoken with David Regal and other people who invent something, and within a month or 2 months or 3 months or whatever, there's probably even faster than that, there's some sort of knockoff on some market in China. And it's the exact same thing. And they're, you know, someone's producing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially YouTube and everything. Somebody can see it instantly and go, oh, okay, I can create that.
Yeah. And people steal lines all the time. And maybe to a certain extent, they may see an effect and try to replicate it. I guess that can't be helped. I mean, when you think about it, at one point, everybody in this country was sawing somebody in half. It didn't even matter who was doing the sawing, you know, according to people like Mike Caveney. It just didn't, because everybody in the 20s, people would sign up and wait in line to be sawed in half. Everybody was sawing somebody in half, and even today, that sort of image is quite prevalent. I mean, how many times have people have said to you, oh, you're married? So do you saw her in half? I bet you do. You know, Kristen, does he saw you in half? So
can you make my husband disappear?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Everybody.
Yeah, you hear this, you know, these kinds of cliches. And I guess the other thing that I was going to say is, you know, sometimes with folks back home in Chicago, we'll talk about how often normal people, even in this day, when you can flip onto YouTube and just see so many different things, it's different. You don't have to know Paul Bachman, who was passed away recently, but he was a juggler and a collector of all things juggling and magic. Mm-hmm. And he was very supportive of me. He was a member of all those old clubs, like in the Chicago area, and he was very, very supportive and a wonderful juggler, bounce juggler. Big guy, very, very gregarious, always smiling, always laughing. And he had a juggling collection that was really phenomenal. But it used to be that if you wanted to know about juggling, you had to go visit Paul Bachman in Palos Hills or wherever, you know, where he lived, if you wanted to see some of these old clips. And now you can see these things on YouTube. But who really does? Whether it's juggling or magic, most people don't. And my point was that, you know, most people will only see magic performed live like once or twice in their lifetime. That's mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, that's a weird thought. I've been thinking about that a lot, actually, lately. It's just like this audience... This may be the only live magic show they ever see. You know, I'm sure they'll see stuff on TV or on YouTube and stuff, but that's a weird thought. You know, I saw this guy do this thing, and, you know, you hope you're doing it well. You're hoping you're doing it in a way that's positive and influential to them. It makes them want to see more magic.
Right, I think, and it would be... It's a huge responsibility when you think about it that way, because I think you're right, and I would take it one step further. I would say that... For some of these people, not only is this their first experience of seeing magic performed live, this may actually be their first experience of a live performance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you and I were fortunate because we came from families that probably at least occasionally took us to go see theater or go to, you know, even if it was a Summerfest, to go see a Christmas Carol is going to be playing. Or, mm-hmm. you know, so, I mean, even if it just happened once a year or once every couple of years, I mean, we got to do that. Mm-hmm. But you know, you start performing at places, you know, in Chicago or these major cities. Or, I mean, you, at Navy Pier, maybe there's a whole group of kids coming, you know, from some sort of park and rec department thing, and maybe they're from some neighborhood or some part of town or some area where it's just a socioeconomically challenged area of town, and these people don't get out and do cultural things.
Yeah,
they don't have mentoring programs like Embark or whatever. I mean, they don't have that stuff. So they just. Don't see this stuff, and then suddenly you're there doing magic, and you have to sort of educate the audience as you go along too, so that they even know what's expected of them. I mean, are they supposed to applaud, laugh, eat more candy, touch all your playing cards with their sticky fingers? Like, what's supposed to be happening here?
Yeah, you just don't know.
No, you don't know, and I bet you really don't know when it's strolling magic, or like that Pyramosphere stuff we're talking about, or street performing. Now that's really something new. They'll probably look at other people and get some idea pretty quickly of how they're supposed to behave, but I can guarantee you for a lot of those people that that's their first experience mm-hmm. seeing mm-hmm. a magician or a juggler or a plate spinner or a contortionist or somebody who's an escapologist. Yeah, that's their first experience.
Sure. And wrapping this up here, what's a career goal, something you haven't achieved, something that you would want to achieve? Would you like to take Fooling Buddha like off Broadway or something major like that?
That would be wonderful. I've been fortunate to create several incarnations of this Fooling Buddha. One that was directed by Sandy Marshall at Magic Inc. Mm-hmm. in Chicago, and then another one that was presented by First Folio, but they didn't really fully produce it. And now First Folio is fully producing it, and it makes a big difference to have a director. Patrick New is a very keen fellow, and he's very... He's got a great eye, and he's really trained in some of this stuff, and he's beginning his career as a theater director in Chicago. So it's exciting to work with him because of his insight. And to really develop this show, it takes more than just one person. You know, there's no such thing as solo performance, not when it's a full mm-hmm. play. So it'd be great to perform that, to do some sort of a tour or perhaps regional theaters, any place where it would be a good match, you know, mm-hmm. and where people would be interested in seeing not only some magic, but hearing some philosophical humor and jumping into a story for about 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for doing this free podcast.
Yeah, this was super fun.
Thanks, buddy.
Good to see you again. Thanks.